You are listening to the Human Rights Podcast, hosted by the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. This is a platform for dialogue and debate on issues related to human rights and international law. Hello, everyone. My name is Kirsten, and on today's episode of the Human Rights Podcast, we have the privilege of listening to a pre-recorded lecture given by Professor Patricia Sellers. This lecture was given this past June at the International Criminal Court Summer School, hosted by the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. Over the next hour, you'll hear a brief introduction by Professor Siobhan Mullally on the work and accomplishments of Professor Sellers. This will be followed by an enlightening presentation from Professor Sellers on slavery crimes at the International Criminal Court. It was an honor to have Professor Sellers speak at the ICC Summer School, and we are very grateful that she has allowed us to share her work with you all. Thank you for your support in listening to the Human Rights Podcast, and we hope you enjoy the presentation.
Welcome back. We're halfway through the summer school and so delighted to see you all here, fresh and ready for a lively day again. We're really delighted to welcome back to Galway Professor Patricia Sellers after, I think, about 10 years since Professor Sellers last visited Galway. At that time, I think at the doctoral symposium hosted by Professor Sheamus. So it's really a great honour. And personally, I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to welcome Professor Sellers to the Summer School to talk about her current work and her work of many years, specifically looking at slavery crimes. Professor Sellers is an advisor to the International Criminal Court, a special advisor on slavery crimes, and has a very distinguished record in international criminal law, particularly on issues relating to sexual violence in conflict, but also on children and armed conflict, and more broadly on women and gender in international law. She is the recipient of many awards, including the prestigious Prominent Women in International Law Award of the American Society of International Law, recognizing her very significant contribution to scholarship and also to practice in international criminal law. I'm sure many of you will be familiar with the landmark cases of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which made such a contribution to international law developments on sexual violence, specifically Akayesu, Kunarak, Furunzija, in which Professor Sellers was prosecutor and led on the strategy and thinking behind the progression of those cases. And they continue to be a key reference point for all of us working in the area of international law across different areas of international law. Professor Sellers is involved in developing scholarship, practice and policy, and thinking and rethinking and shaping the work of the International Criminal Court, as we were just discussing this morning, at a time when there is a lot happening, a lot of reflection on the next stages of the work and the practice of the court, including particularly on slavery crimes and on the nexus with questions around the rights of the child in international law, the child policy at the ICC, and the policy on sexual violence and gender crimes. So we're really delighted, and it's a very unique opportunity to have Professor Sellers traveling all the way to Galway on planes and buses and to take the time to meet with you this morning. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. So the title is Slavery Crimes Under International Criminal Law. And one could ask, and I'm sure that people have asked Prosecutor Karim Khan, you know, why do you need a special advisor on slavery crimes? And I think one of his answers might be, well, when I asked Patricia Sellers, would you like to be my special advisor at large, because I'd been the special advisor for gender, I said, no, I want to be the special advisor for slavery crimes. And he was a little taken aback, but in the past 10 or 15 years, and particularly since the Kunarats case, slavery crimes have been occupying a lot about how I can understand international criminal law, and particularly crimes against humanity and war crimes. And so I asked Karim, can I be the special advisor for slavery crimes? And I think almost until today, Karim and I are in the midst of having certain discussions, that it is just very slowly dawning on him, part of my colleagues, and I would even say the larger academic public, and then you as students and practitioners, the role that slavery crimes really do play in international criminal law. Today's lecture is going to start by having you shake up in your mind and in your head a little bit of our concepts of what is slavery. And only then will we move to really talking about some of the definitions and some of the cases. Let me start, because the first part is, it's all about the pictures. I don't know if you can see this picture, but it reminds us that slavery taken around as a spiritual, cultural, economic way of structuring society since at least 2000 BC. And I emphasize that slavery itself entails economic. A slave is either doing something or can be valued in some way, and that slavery systems entail how a society culturally starts wrapping itself around values. There's a value to being not enslaved, just as there might be an economic value in fleeing slave. And that slavery also becomes something that's very rooted in our political systems and our legal systems. Because whenever you have slaves within your system, you have to make laws about the slave, you know, and you have to regulate slavery. So it becomes part of our legal system, part of our political system, to the extent that I think that many cultures in the world and many political entities, countries, could have also been referred to as slaveocracies. Societies built on the organization that included slavery. This shows us, and I'm going to concentrate on slavery right now between 1400 until 1910, in terms of what is the East African slave trade. Many of us are familiar with the transatlantic slave trade, the West Africa slave trade. But prior to that, and continuing until that was even abolished, was the East African trade. And the East African trade, just saying from the 1400s, although it preceded it, irrespective of the cultures and religion, the East African trade took and depopulated large parts of East Africa into the Southern Peninsula, into Zanzibar, even into India. A lot of our concepts of slavery in terms of the East African trade have just basically been reduced to a couple of stereotypes. But this East African slave trade has some fundamental bases that impact on how we understand slavery today. Now, this is just a picture of the East African trade. I don't know how many of you can see it, but what could stand out to you that the East African trade in many ways was a type of Islamic, Arab, but Muslim trade. And that is because in East Africa and the Saudi Peninsula, Oman, the social structure was basically Islamic Muslim structure. And that under the Quran, having a slave was completely legal. The slavery of East Africa took place on plantations, such as clove plantations, cinnamon plantations. When we think of the spice coming out of Zanzibar, think of plantation labor. But also the slavery took place in the home, household slavery. And that household slavery was often a feminine slavery, doing, you know, labor, regular housework, but also the systems of concubines. There is something where slavery defines a society, but even more so can define individuals within the society. And what occurred within the East African slave trade to a certain extent is that Quranic law said you can enslave the non-Islamic person, you cannot enslave your own. It wasn't based upon race, it was based upon religion. So you couldn't enslave the Islamic person. So what do you think the non-Islamic person did if they thought they were going to be enslaved?
Converted.
Among the reason that Islam spreads in certain parts of East Africa, and particularly in Zanzibar, is that the non-Islamic person said, the way out, I become a Muslim. I won't be enslaved. So this in some ways shows the reaction to slavery, and it's a reaction that is based upon religion. Military slavery in Goa. Why would there be military slavery in Goa that is taking East Africa? It's because among the European nations, Portugal was about the first nation that would capture Africans because Portugal was a seafaring power in the 1400s and in the 1500s. It had already set up in São Tomé a type of pre-run of a plantation system. It sets up the Fort Elmina of Ghana, but the Portuguese ships go around the Horn of Africa into what we know of today, Mozambique, and up to East African coast. But they also have a small foothold holding where? In India, in Goa. And Goa is among one of the last places to be decolonized in India in the 1950s. So the Portuguese take the East Africans and they set up an army. It's basically a Portuguese army in Goa made up of male. And so this relationship of military captive being placed in an army and being enslaved is a very ancient notion. One of the most frequent forms of enslavement are the slaves that work in your military, or that staff in your military. Okay, so now the next picture that you cannot see is a picture of a slave dungeon in Zanzibar. And the reason I place that in is that we often have a much clearer notion of transatlantic slavery. And if you ever go to Charleston or you go to Montgomery, Alabama, you will see slave blocks, places where people were auctioned off. And we have an ideal of Gorée and Senegal of the door to nowhere. But we really don't have a concept of slavery in Zanzibar and where were slaves held. Well, prior to being sold or transported via the ocean, they were held in these tiny, tiny cells. And I've been in one. You can't even stand up. And so what you almost have to do is lay down or sit down. And what distinguishes some of those cells, that they held males and females together. On the West African coast, usually men and females were separated prior to being enslaved. So we have to understand that this is not just a slavery center, it's a slave trading center. And we'll get into the relationship of slave trading and slavery a little bit later. So the next picture that you probably can't see is some picture that was taken by the British who stopped one of the slave trading ships that was leaving East Africa, the Zanzibar coast going. And if you notice, it stopped it in order to pick up the slaves on the ship and take them back into East Africa as they were negotiating with caliphates to free the slaves. So it's an ordinary picture of who was enslaved. And if you could look at it closely, you see elderly adults, middle-aged adults. You see, in quotes, men and women in their prime. And you see children. And they're all Black Africans, not coming from the north of Africa, who were not Muslim. This cargo of slaves was probably worth our equivalent today of upwards of $500,000 to $1 million. This is the huge cast. And it's not just the slave in their actual age. It's the reproductive capacity of the slave, the work capacity of the slave, and how they can fit into your society, and how they can be used as goods in which to sell. Still with the East African trade, here's a picture of a concubine. Now, a concubine was part of what one could euphemistically call the domestic labor in the house. And under Quranic law, you could marry four women legitimately, but you could have an untold number of concubines in your house that males could have sexual access to. This was an integral part of the East African trade, but also within the slave trade that the Ottoman Empire conducted. Concubines came from places in Central Europe, places such as the Ukraine, places such as even into Slav territories of Poland, in addition to coming through Ethiopia. And some of the Ethiopian women were very prized, as were women from Central Asia or Eastern Europe. I want to tell you something about the concubine, because we can look at them very much and say, well, this is sexual slavery. Well, yeah, I would agree. This is sexualized enslavement, I would say, because of the sexual access to the concubine and the role of the concubine. But you know, too, that what often happens when people live in your same house, if they are your house workers, they develop relationships. They say, well, we treat her just like family. Well, she is really just like family. And even the other wives might say, well, yeah, she's like a little sister. But this is an enslaved woman. She's dressed very fancy. I mean, she's dressed so that you could show her off, almost as if it were a type of pet. So we have to lose our notion that slaves only wear ragged clothes. Sometimes they look like they're upper class compared to other people within a town, but that doesn't mean that they're not enslaved. So how important was concubine slavery? Well, it was this important. In East Africa, about 1889, 1900, the British are coming in and they're occupying. They're negotiating with the Sultan of Oman and the other political leaders to stop the enslavement of East Africans and to stop making slavery part of their society. And by 1900s, you were able, if you were an enslaved person, to ask for manumission. You would have to go to a court. You would have to declare on papers. You would say that I want to be free, and your master would have to go through the paperwork. Well, the Sultan of Oman and in East Africa, they asked, could they have a 10-year abeyance? Can we just prolong the concubine slavery for 10 more years? If not, it would disrupt the family relationship. So did you get that rationale? That's probably not from the point of view of the enslaved woman, right? It's from the point of view of she probably likes being here, or we treat her well. Part of the rationale was that if we let concubine women go, the prostitution is going to go up. What will they do in the street? They'll just become prostitutes. What is that saying about women being unattached to families or masters, the uncontrolledness of their sexuality, compared to when they're a concubine and can be sexually assaulted under the legality of enslavement every day? So concubine slavery doesn't end until 1910, East Africa. And as we know today, when we look at issues of ISIS, the sabaya, the concubine that one can bring into the house as war continues, this is part of the heritage of the East African trades. Another part is I want to let you know that slaves did not accept their situation. one of the most famous results happens in 869 through 888. And it's a rebellion of East African slaves in Persia. And for almost 20 years, the rebellion holds. These East African slaves in Persia were basically plantation slaves, agricultural slaves, but that had ties with some of the urban slaves. Among the reasons I want to bring this out is that when we think of slavery, the rebellious slave is often individualized as the runaway slave, as opposed to understanding that many slaves self-organized and rebelled against the economic, the political, and the cultural system with arms and with usually their own blood. The next picture that is the memorial in Zanzibar to slavery. And it's a very peculiar memorial because you have to walk up to it and it's in the ground. It's not the heroic slave standing up. You look in the ground and you see enslaved people that are female, male, adult, and children. And the fact that you have to physically approach and then you have to bend over is somewhere saying the humiliation of the slaves, that you have to bow down. East African slavery is basically erased from our minds. Now I'd like to show you the transatlantic slavery. But the transatlantic slavery basically starts from the 1500s up until 1850. And here you see Africa and then the slave routes that go to South America, to the Caribbean, and then up to North America. What I want to show you here is the duration. We're talking about an economic, political, social system. That's for hundreds and hundreds of years. This isn't kind of a five-year, you know, term of a presidency. So you can imagine how much it influenced history, cultural, politics, economic. The majority of the slaves go to where? To South America, and particularly to Brazil. And among the reasons is because the Portuguese had colonized Brazil. The Portuguese had been into enslaving longer than other European countries. As a matter of fact, they start to have the monopoly until the French and the English and the Spanish break it. But it's also the reason why today Brazil has the largest black population other than Nigeria in the world. It's a result of the transatlantic slave. The other slavery that goes in here is in the Caribbean. And the Caribbean become the hub for both the Danish, the English, and Spanish, and the French in terms of where they bring slaves and then where they continue to further export slaves, such as into North America. And in North America, particularly the United States, where I'm from, and as a descendant of a slave, we actually receive a very small percentage of the estimated 12 to 14 million Africans who are enslaved. We're about 500,000 actually reach the American coast. One would almost step back and have to say, why is the Caribbean black? Why are those black nations? The only reason that the majority of them are black nations is the annihilation of the native population and because of the institution of slavery. I also would like to point out to you that this is the slave trade, this transportation, this bringing of slaves. We should refer to that as the slave trade. How did this slave trade manifest? I'm with a slide that says the French outfitted ship for the triangular slave trade. Now, this is the ship that probably came out as Liebignol, maybe even a shell, that could have come out of the liberal school. Because what slave trading did was start industry in New York. And among each industry till it started was outfitting ships for triangular trade. What does a triangular trade's purpose? Well, it was a type of globalization, an economic globalization. It upped the number of seafarers or marines or matelots. That became a profession that you could get a job in without being educated. And it increased the manufacturing of guns and arms in Europe. Why? Because you would take those guns and arms and you would go to Africa. And since many of the enslaved Africans were now provided by stirring up wars among different African polities, and they would capture their prisoners of war or raid not necessarily the coastal towns, but the inland towns, and bring those people to the coast to be enslaved. So gun and the gun industry became important to enslavement, the bringing of guns to Africa. And then the same ship would then have to take the enslaved Africans over to maybe the Caribbean. And then the same ship would then have to return to its port. And what was it bringing? Well, from the Caribbean, it was probably bringing rum, probably bringing sugar. And it became very fashionable in Europe for the upper class to have a bowl of sugar on their table. The patisserie industry of France is highly refined by the use now of white sugar. Sometime the boat returned with cotton and gauze cotton from the French aristocracy also became the mode for a la mode for the summer. What I'm trying to show is that the economic trade should trade in weapons and in fuel and the bringing back of certain products was integral to slave trading. Today, we have to look and see, you know, what products, you know, that used to be the soccer balls from the children who made them in Pakistan, or the coltan in our phones that might come from enslaved people from the Congo. Slavery touched almost every aspect of much of the elite of Europe. When one goes to Amsterdam, look at those houses along the canals. A lot of those houses descend from people who insured the slave vessels. This is another interesting aspect of the slave trade. If you notice, I say the colonial slave port in the Americas, because slavery extends from when most of North and South America were colonies, but it continues until those states are independent. So they continued the practice of slave trading and enslavement. That bolstered the colonial empires, but that part did not change when we had independent states. What you can certainly understand is that independence is a way of saying, I no longer want European domination. But that didn't coincide with saying, I want freedom for the slave. Another part of slave trade that we entirely forget. The majority of slave trading occurs internally inside the country. It is not the image of the ship coming across that should limit our understanding of slave trading. Within the United States, there's slave trading, and particularly from Maryland down into Mississippi through the waterways. There is slave trading that goes westward, southward. If you're in Brazil, the slave might disembark in Bahia and end up in Maranhão. That internal slave trading remained legal even after the British in 1808 started making bilateral treaties with enslaving nations to say, let's stop the transatlantic slave trade. And so it made treaties with the United States, made treaties with Brazil, with some of the French, and it set up courts where these ships could emptied if they held slaves, and the slaves were dumped back into Africa, and particularly into Freetown, Sierra Leone, hence one of the meanings of the name of Freetown. But that international slave trading did not stop the internal trade, and most importantly, it was not aimed to stop slavery. So what was the reaction, for example, in the United States and in Brazil when the transatlantic slave trade stops? Well, you have to start growing your own slaves and then increasing the internal domestic export-importation of them, which means that you have to have slaves that can procreate, which is a euphemistic way of saying the increase of the sexual abuse of the slaves in order to produce a more enslaved person. So female slaves might have been raped by, in quotes, their masters, but female slaves were often raped by male slaves or just told like animals to reproduce, so that the female did not own her vagina, but the male slave did not own their own semen. They could be told where to place that semen for the wealth of the owner. This is the sign in Montgomery, Alabama, because Montgomery becomes one of the main internal port cities, because it's on the Charleston River. I'm getting my rivers mixed up, right? But the reason I put this sign there, you can't read it, it talks about we're holding children. So this is a good place if you want to buy enslaved children. Enslaved children was a niche market in the slavery market. There were other niche markets, like a wench means a woman who would reproduce, or a stud, a man who was virile and has reproduced other slaves or children. It was so common, the different genders and the age disaggregation of the enslaved, that one could advertise it. So I like to say it was not a secret, wasn't even the public secret. Here we have domestic slavery in the United States. Very common. If you were middle class and wealthy enough, you usually had someone else taking care of your children. You know, we reproduce that today, but not as enslaved persons. Well, part of the duties of this type of domestic labor was to breastfeed children. So the enslaved woman did not own the milk in her breasts. And in Charleston, and particularly in urban slavery, women such as her could be loaned out to other women after they had children so that the white women's breasts wouldn't fall, but yet the child would be nourished. And you have to imagine that a woman has breast milk. Why? Because she has probably birthed her own child. So this is literally taking milk out of the mouth of one child to provide for another. This is called wet nursing in the United States. The same practice occurs in Brazil. It's called mercenary nursing. If you read to the archive of the extraordinary criminal chambers of Cambodia, you will find that the Khmer Rouge did the same thing. That they had certain women set aside who would breastfeed babies while their mothers continued to do work, slave labor in the field. This is a picture of an African-American slave who was Muslim, Omar bin Said. He was captured when he was about 37. Knew how to read and write Arabic. Had been highly educated. As a matter of fact, after he obtains his freedom, he goes back to West Africa and writes an autobiography. One of the things that's very important with him is to note that there's a part of the enslaved population from West Africa that was Muslim. And unlike the East African trade, you could not convert to Christianity and therefore protect yourself from being enslaved. The churches decided, well, we will pray for your soul, but in the meantime, we will enslave your body. But because he was writing in Arabic, none of his, in quotes, masters or owners could understand what he was writing. They thought it was scribbling. So there was a type of network of Muslim African American slaves. And within our community, even prior to the 1980s, the new Black Muslim movement, there are people called Bay, B-E-Y. And we know that they descend from these Muslim enslaved persons. But the United States, of course, like I said, received a small percentage of free enslaved, who showed me that in Brazil, the larger percentage, there were also enslaved Muslims. This is a Muslim woman, slave in Brazil. You notice she has prayer beads in her hands. But a lot of that can be diffused under the beings from the Candomblé religion. But the Muslim slaves in Brazil knew of each other. There was an imam. And one of the largest slave rebellions that occur in the New World are the Muslim slaves of Brazil. They're referred to as the Malé. And the Malé de la Bay is celebrated until today, the uprising of the Muslim slaves. But someone sold them out the day before the rebellion. But they continued. There was a lot of bloodshed. But afterwards, the Portuguese put certain ones on trial, killed others, and then dispersed the others out of Bahia. They didn't want these Muslim communities to communicate with each other. And they did another thing that's extraordinary. There's a group of the Muslim slaves, so they said, we're sending you back to Africa. We don't want you here. We can't break you. And until today, in the carnival of Bahia, there's always a Bloco Africa, which is a type of band that celebrates the rebellion of the Malé de la Bay. This switches us to European concepts of enslavement, coterminous to slavery in the New World, and at times the enslaved here in Europe. And what you're looking at now is a painting by a Dutch master, Van Kouwenberg, and it's called The Rape of the Needed. This painting is around that time period when college Amsterdam is in its glory. You have to ask yourself, we know who painted that picture. Who commissioned that picture to be painted? And usually we think of women being raped at armed conflict. There's always, oh, the rape of the Sabine women, you know, that dates back into Roman and pre-Roman times. But this wasn't that long ago. And this painting is still hanging in a museum in France today. The other memento of slavery in Europe deals with a doorknob painting. Beautiful. It's gold. It's in Venice. There are neighborhoods in Venice that we walk around on the other side of the Grand Canal that often have this doorknob handle of an African, a remnant of when the African survey would meet you at the door. You know, in the States today, we have the little black boy standing with the lantern, because many black children were the first jockeys for horses at the Kentucky Derby or steeplechase. And these mementos kind of stick in our mind, but we really don't know how and where to place them. This is from Prague. You often see this Africanized person holding up, you know, a coffee table, the ormolu, or a building. So there was no denying that slavery shaped European countries, even if great slave populations or enslaved populations weren't here. The reason I show you this is to talk about the third slave trade, which in some ways has really gone underground in our minds. And that's the Barbary Coast European lace. And it lasted basically from 1500 to 1825. And we're talking a little bit over 300 years. Now, how many of you know about the Barbary Coast slavery of Europeans. There were over 1,200,000 Europeans that were enslaved by countries, today we'd call them countries in Northern Africa, although they might have been more city-states. So it's basically Morocco, one of the pashas of Tripoli, Algiers. And the Barbary pirates would come up even to Northern Europe, and particularly on the English coast, of course, into Italy. As a matter of fact, they raided places such as Iceland. They would take farmers, but they would often take people who were on fishing ships. And they would take them back into these Barbary islands, and they were Muslims for the most part. This starts after the expulsion of Muslims from Spain. And a lot of the enslavement dealt with urban slavery, very little plantation slavery, and concubine slavery, very similar to other Arab or Muslim slavery. But in our mind today, we conflate that Barbary pirate slavery with piracy, legal concepts of piracy. Some of them were corsairs, the chance that they couldn't legitimately be privateer. But once you go into piracy, you can see that it seems to have an illegality out. And that the Algon of Palermo, which later, you know, we all work on legally, at the Isle of Palermo is rated 136 times in terms of taking white Italians being enslaved in Northern. The fact of conflating this with piracy means that we don't talk about what? We don't talk about slave trading, right? We talk about the bad deeds of the pirate. This type of slavery and slave trading also has been referred to as the white slavery. And that's because during the transatlantic slave, racial connotations start to attach to enslaved. They didn't during the East African slave trade. The master and the East African might have resembled and looked like each other. Transatlantic slave trade, no. So by the time we get to the enslavement of Europeans, the notion of white slavery can be said because the construct of race has attached to enslavement. The Barbary slave trade was very beneficial to the United States, and particularly in two ways. The United States was, in quotes, a fledgling nation, a new nation, early 1800s. And it sent warships over to Northern Africa to confront the Barbary pirates because it refused to pay tribute. This warfare was successful for the United States. It gained the admiration of other countries. The United States begins to construct its Navy and its U.S. Marines based upon this warfare. President Jefferson is involved, and even Ben Franklin. I'm from Philadelphia, and Ben Franklin is our patron saint, was involved. And they asked for the release of the enslaved whites. Now, you have to hold the irony, because what is happening in the United States during the same period? Enslavement. But they could recognize that enslavement and slave trading was wrong in asking for their relief, and could use this not only to build military forces, but to build respect from European nations. And so I'm always asking, well, why have we forgotten this part of slave? Well, I don't exactly know the answer. But what I do know that this is one of the most curious omissions, not only in history, but in our legal history. So let's turn to some of the legal things. Now look at what is slavery from a legal point of view. And I hope that I've just shaken up and put new images in your head from a psychological and a human point of view. We know that slavery / enslavement, I might use those two words kind of interchangeably, is governed by two international conventions, the 1926 Convention and the 1956 Convention. The 1926 Convention to suppress the slave trade and enslavement comes out of the League of Nations, whereas the 1956 Supplementary Convention for Slavery, the Slave Trades, and Similar Practices comes out of the United Nations because it has been set up. And so slavery is defined in those two conventions, and it's a definition that you can basically memorize. So slavery is the status or the condition of a person over whom any or all the powers attaching to the rights of ownership are exercised. So you are enslaved if someone is exercising any or all the powers of ownership over you. And I want to underscore that the exercise of these powers can be de jure, I mean a legal paper, or they could be de facto. They could be customs and practices. You no longer have to, in quotes, prove it with a paper. That was among the great steps forward within the 26th Convention, continues in the 56th Convention, that we're just not talking about the slavery that's written on the books. We're talking about practices and customs. So what one has to understand when one is looking at slavery crimes is to say, it is the perpetrator exercising powers, any or all, over a person. And how could you have evidence of that? You know, it could be physical, it could be psychological. It could be control of your sexuality, or it could be control of your ability to interact with anyone. And there's a difference of saying, I'm being intimidated, I'm being leaned on, to exercising powers of control. The exceptions in many national constitutions is imprisonment. That imprisonment will not be seen to be enslavement. Okay, the next one is a little more difficult, and I want to tell you, hang with me. What is the slave trade? Today we often talk about, oh, someone was kidnapped, someone was acquired, someone was recruited. But under the conventions, the slave trade is a bit more complicated than slave. So we're going to walk through the slave trade definition so that we understand it. As I said, defined in both conventions, there are three types of conduct that could comprise the slave trade. And that is, the slave trade includes all acts involved in the capture, acquisition, or disposal. And if you're a lawyer, you should look at that word disposal, because it goes wide as this. Or the disposal of a person with the intent to reduce him, and I added in, or her, to slavery. It basically is how you get a free person into a situation of having powers, ownership, exercised over. Do you have to take them across an ocean? No, you can take them to the next room. You could capture them. You could acquire them. It's any way that you dispose of them from being free to being enslaved. It's a very broad definition that really just wants to get to the act of reducing someone to enslavement. The next part of that definition, and look at it closely, it's all the acts involved in the acquisition of a slave with a view to selling or exchanging him or her. So here you're not going from free to slave, you're going from enslaved to a different situation of enslavement. So the enslaved and the slave can further be slave traded. Why is that important? Think about the internal slave trade I was describing to you. Most of that internal slave trade within a country was really slave trading. So slave trading can be a precursor to enslavement and can intercede with enslavement. And the third part of the definition of the slave trade conforms that. All acts of disposal by sale or exchange of a slave with a view to being sold or exchanged, and in general, every act of trade, transport, and slave. So what about the riverboat captain? The person selling on the auction block but not buying? Our vision of who is a perpetrator of slave trade should now break open to you. And not be a cliched, oh, you know, just the captain on the ship. And the point is that most of the enslaved were slave traded many times. A lot of the slave trade occurs among family members. I'm going to give you John as part of your dowry so that when you leave the house, you have slaves. They can be a gift. They can be collateral for a loan. These are acts of slave trade. Slavery and the slave trade are not only just part of international law, but they're part of international customary law, meaning you don't have to sign the treaties anymore. You're bound by it. Under the International Committee for the Red Cross, not only their customary law, they're also war crimes. Rule 94, which states that slavery and the slave trade in all their forms, whether it be concubinage, whether it be urban slavery, whether it be wet nursing, whether it be working in the fields, whether it be military, are prohibited as war crimes. Slavery and the slave trade are peremptory norm. Now we know as international lawyer, once something's a peremptory norm, you are to bow down. That means there's no wiggle room. Because the peremptory norms have erga omnes obligations on the state. There are no exceptions in all circumstances. And I can't do that Latin phrase, o delari, o demeri. I'm looking at just Bill for help. Well, it's the one where if you can't prosecute, you're supposed to send to the third jurisdiction that
can't. Obligatory home to the car.
Thank you. It's like if the slave trader is here or the enslaver, and you say, yeah, really like to go after them, but I can't. You have erga omnes obligations, but then you have to transfer them to the jurisdictions that can't. You cannot ignore slave, or you could be coming complicit in the enslavement. The definition of enslavement under the Rome Statute, which governs the International Criminal Court, is slightly different. It says enslavement is a crime against humanity, means the exercise of any or all the powers attaching to the rights of ownership over a person. We got that part now. That part you should be memorizing by now. And includes the exercise of such powers in the course of trafficking over such person, and particularly women and children. That's the definition in the Rome Statute, and it later goes down within a footnote to give examples of selling, lending, or buying as a form of exercising powers of ownership or deprivation of liberty. If you read the statutory construction of this definition, and then you look into the elements of the offenses or elements of the crimes in the Rome Statute, it says that the perpetrator exercised any or all the powers attaching to the right of ownership over a person, and that such as purchasing, selling, lending, or bartering such a person or persons, or by imposing on them a similar deprivation of liberty. What you have to prove first and foremost is exercising powers attaching to the rights of ownership. That's the key. If you have conduct that is selling or conduct that is barter, you have to show first that the umbrella of exercising powers attaching to the right of ownership have occurred. If you have conduct of traffic, and we'll get to that definition, you have to show that that occurred under exercising any of all the power attaching the right of owners. Let's go to sexual slavery. Under the Rome Statute, sexual slavery is a provision under crimes against humanity and under war crimes. The elements of sexual slavery, by now you should be getting bored because, of course, it begins with love. The perpetrator exercised any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership over the person. And it says such as by purchasing lending that you say, I'm getting it, I'm bleeding it, I'm getting it, except to the last clause. For sexual slavery is that the perpetrator caused such person or persons to engage in an act of a sexual nature. What's an act of a sexual nature? What do you think that they're talking about here? What pops to your mind is rape, right? You call someone to be raped and you rape someone. Okay, now think back to some of our images and discussion. What if you're waiting for the Ting Ting girls to have their first period so that they can become, in quotes, bushwives? Is that being caused to engage in an act of a sexual nature?
Preparing, sort of.
Does it, yeah, but I'm, you know, and it goes, it doesn't fall within the, neatly within the definition.
No, kind of. Yeah, okay.
But we know what's going to happen at the end.
That's the end of the story, right? That's on current facts. Okay, what about the breast milk? Is breastfeeding a child an act of a sexual nature? What about being told that you cannot rape someone? The control of your sexuality, but because you cannot rape someone, is that an act of a sexual nature?
It's an consent. Consent is.
Well, I'm happy you made that observation. Well, that's why that third phrase that I personally, and I forget to say that I'm speaking in my personal capacity right now, doesn't quite pick up how we've learned and described what happens under enslavement, because enslavement can be sexualized. People can exercise powers of ownership over you in a sexualized form, and you're not necessarily being caused to engage in an act of sexual nature. And when I look at sexual slavery, I mean, it's in the statute, but at the same time, I understand how the rush to make that the definition occurred. This is from a very heterocentric, patriarchal notion of rape, not from a survivor of enslavement might have had many sexualized parts to it. This really doesn't cover me. And if I had my druthers, and I don't even know what druthers are, or would I really want them, I would try and make us understand that the definition of enslavement actually is much broader and covers any type of sexualized indicia of exercising parts of ownership, and that sexual slavery should be consumed or repositioned as it is under customary law inside of enslavement. Because what happens under the Rome Statute is that once you charge or you convict for sexual slavery, since the first element, exercising powers attaching to any of the rights of ownership, your enslavement falls out. You were seen as being sexually enslaved without understanding the fuller nature of your enslavement. And also what happens is that this becomes a very feminized charge. We see it applying to females, and you have to prove an extra element that they were caused to be engaged, right? And we find that males are basically charged under enslavement. But to their detriment is that we start to ignore the means of how males are also sexually enslaved. The example I gave you of not being allowed to rape occurred in Ongun, and that person was shot. If they attempted to rape or had access to a bushwhite, and they were shot dead on the spot. In essence, their sexuality was controlled. It comes under enslavement, but not understood as a sexualized part of enslavement. And role of, in quotes, the bushwives are under sexual slavery, and that's after they menstruate. That's after they've been slave traded out to an owner, as if we ignore the other parts of their slavery experience or say, well, don't worry, it's put under Section 1. So I think that we're still working on slavery crimes. And we still have work to do, but before we can do that, we have to open up and start understanding and visualizing historic and current enslavement so that we know that. The Yazidi girl who has been enslaved with her mother, and the mother is being held out for rapes every night, the Yazidi girl, in essence, is also sexually enslaved. She's being groomed. the Yazidi girl who's given birth control, is that being held out for an act of a sexual nature? But it's a sexualized form of enslavement. Consent. You brought it up, and let me just say, consent is legally irrelevant. The definitions we've gone under, consent is legally irrelevant as an element or as a defense to slavery, enslavement, or to slave trade. If you consent to be a slave, it in no way means that the charges can be dismissed. If you consent to be slave traded, it might not even get in. I would object to it coming in as neither probative or relevant evidence. You do not have to prove abusive, coercive circumstances, neither for slavery or for slave trade. What the law can concentrate on it is the mentality of the perpetrator. It's more analogous to torture. We're concerned about the intent to reduce someone to slavery or knowingly taking the free person to the enslavement situation or the slave to subsequent situations of enslavement. And we're in the head of the perpetrator to understand, well, what are the powers attached to the right of ownership that you are exercising? Sometimes the slave can give us parts of that information, but we're not concerned with whether the slave, did you consent or you didn't consent? Did you want to really have sex or not have sex? Did you mind if they checked your menstruation, you know, or not? Like torture, these are perpetrator-driven crimes. And that's why it's important to see what the perpetrator knowingly does. What's the situation of enslavement that the perpetrator creates? What the slave trader intends to do for that person? So now let me turn to trafficking. And let me step back and say that trafficking and its relationship to slavery and the slave trade. First of all, as I said to you, the 1926 Convention, 1956 Convention, League of Nations, United Nations, with all this historical background of enslavement, also has attached to it World War II, deportation to slave labor. Did you know that 500,000 Polish women? Yes, that's right. 500,000 Polish women were deported to slave labor during World War II into Germany. Deportation should be seen as slave traded into Germany. We know upwards of 200,000, in quotes, comfort women were discomfited by their enslavement as they were transported around South Asia to provide sexual acts to Japanese soldiers. So in between the two conventions, we have huge instances of enslavement, prisoners of war, British prisoners of war, enslaved labor. But simultaneous to that, we have the development of a whole other legal regime. And it's the legal regime that pertains to trafficking. And as you can see, in the 1904 International Convention for the Suppression of the White Slavery Trade, as it applied to white women and girls. Now, what should be ringing off on your mind? Barbary pirates, slavery, okay? This is a convention that is basically a morality convention. It's to stop the cross-border forced prostitution of white women and girls. Slavery has not been outlawed at this time. International. The second convention is a convention in 1910 on the trafficking of children for the exploitation and prostitution, and it applied to white children. It didn't apply to black children or other non-white children who were either currently enslaved, let's say Zanzibar, or recently freed. And then we have the 1921 convention for the suppression of trafficking in women and children, and it applied to all women and all children. And then the last one that I can barely see that I put in there is the 1949 Convention on the Suppression of the Traffic in Persons and the Exploitation of Prostitution of Others. So we see that trafficking comes out of this morality phrase set of stopping prostitution and the exploitation of prostitution. There are no cross references in either of the two regimes to each other. They have different policy bases. They have different legal approaches. And they also have a different history for a very good reason. The trafficking history really talks about how do we use our national policing to stop cross-border and then finally internal trafficking for sexual exploitation. A difference between trafficking and slavery and slave trade is that in certain situations, consent is relevant with trafficking. So if you're an adult and you ask, would you traffic me to Belgium for sexual exploitation? I hear I can make good money and I can give you some as a prostitute. That's not a crime. Trafficking hasn't. If you use coercive circumstance to get the consent to that person and the exploitation occurs, then trafficking is. If you're a child, consent becomes legally irrelevant. So a big difference between those two legal regimes is in one regime, consent plays absolutely no part. In the other regime, there's a qualified consent that could be possible. The relationship between trafficking and the slave trade, trafficking comes out of the Palermo Protocol. Now, didn't I mention Palermo 124? Palermo was the site of extensive slave trading and raiding with the Barbary Pirates. And I think that it's not completely haphazard that trafficking has been named after the Palermo Protocol. Because somewhere, I think in our mind, there are just the retentions of the women, the European women that were held by their Orientalism or the Barbary Pirates. It's never written anywhere, but when you read the 49 Convention and the other conventions and the emphasis on women being forced to prostitute themselves, it's one of the few hangovers that we still have from Barbary Pirates. But the other thing that the Palermo Protocol does, and see this definition, trafficking in person shall mean the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of person by means of the threat or use of force or other forms of coercion, of abduction, of fraud, deception, the abuse of power, or of a position of vulnerability, of the giving or the receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of the person having control over another person for the purpose of exploitation. In some ways, it's describing a situation that reposes on consent and reposes on force. But it also reposes on something, and that's international crime. Who are the pirates of today? The international criminal organizations, right? Trafficking under Palermo includes, at a minimum, the exploitation and the prostitution of others, but it also could include forced labor, services, slavery, or practices similar to slavery. But the focus on trafficking has usually been on the first two parts, the means, the capture, and then we kind of get reduced to exploitation, and that gets vague because the exploitation doesn't have the crisp elements. Well, what is forced labor? And now I would ask you today, well, what is slavery? Are we going to prove that they were exercising powers of ownership and that they were slave traded? Trafficking seems to concentrate more on the first two elements. And as I said again, trafficking differs because adults have a qualified consent, whereas children, only children, are excluded from consent. Let's quickly remember that slavery and the slave trade, too, are human rights violations. Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They're also violations under the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. You have a right not to be held in slavery. That's non-derogable. You also have a right not to be slave traded. And that's not the same thing as a right not to be trafficked. There has been some recent slavery crimes jurisprudence from the International Criminal Court. The most recent is Onwit, where we have the enslavement of adults and children who were picked up from their villages and forced to labor as porters. We have young girls referred to as teen teens who had to guard other children until they menstruated and therefore could become bush wives. And we have the sexual slavery of women and girls who had menstruated. We have that under crimes against humanity, and we have sexual slavery under war crimes. But under the Rome Statute, there are no war crimes that relate to slavery and the slave trade. It's a huge omission. There is also the case in Kunerats. How Kunerats different is that it's all based on customary law. Kunerats talks about enslavement under which sexualized enslavement is contained. And Kunerats does not talk about sexual slavery. What neither of those cases talk about, or the third case in Taganda, is slave trade, because there's no provision for slave trade under the Rome Statute, neither in crimes against humanity or war crimes. I personally think also it's a huge omission. So does Sierra Leone, one of the countries, ASP, that's promoting it. And the last case is really the prosecutor versus Ntaganda. The reason I bring this in is that under war crimes, sexual slavery was charged and there was a conviction for it. In addition, rape was charged and there was a conviction. And it's the first time that there have been convictions for sexual slavery and rape for same side persons, meaning that the person in the militia who sexually enslaved someone else in their same militia can commit a war crime. And if that person does not have to be hors de combat in order to reach the jurisdictional level, or if it were an international armed conflict, an enemy from the same side. We have different jurisdictions for slavery crimes. Let me go over those quickly. There's state-to-state jurisdiction at the International Criminal Court. One state can bring another state from violating the slavery conventions. Have you ever read the jurisprudence on that? No, because no state has ever done that. Even though we know that slavery is occurring today, and some of it is occurring, in particular, it's a human rights violation where states are not using due diligence. There's also jurisdiction for slavery that we can look at from individuals that can go to different treaty bodies, such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And then we have the state versus the individual in national courts. For example, Holland has on its penal statute slave trade, but it's rarely used. Usually they run to smuggling, where they can use trafficking as opposed to doing cumulative charges. Australia has a slave trade on its penal code, rarely used. They'll use trafficking as opposed to combining the two, or from the survivor's point of view, which crime am I more likely to receive a conviction on? We also have, of course, the International Crime of the Individual, ICC, ICTY, the Rwanda Tribunal, the Cambodian Tribunal, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and in regional courts, such as ECOWAS, such as the Inter-American Court. So there are many jurisdictions that I think are being underutilized in terms of slavery crimes or in terms of cumulative convictions for slavery trafficking and for possibly smuggling. A lot of that is our lack of legal knowledge, but much more of it is our lack of psychological barriers of understanding slavery and slave trade. This is one of the most recent released slaves. She was just released in 2021 in Brazil. She'd been enslaved for 40 years. She came to a house when she was 8 years old. She was hungry. She asked for food. They kept her there, and she worked for them her entire life without any pay. I mentioned before that domestic slavery was a huge part of slavery. And from that, there are descendant practices in certain countries, and particularly in Brazil, where the majority of slaves went, of usually black women who are empregadas domésticas, slaves, domestic workers within houses, and some of those women are enslaved. We know that there are systems in the Middle East. I'm currently involved in a case in Lebanon, where young women coming up from Ethiopia, passports are taken away, and somewhere there comes a moment when they've been freed. They're reduced to enslavement, and they remain enslaved. The woman in the case I'm involved in has not been paid in 8 years, could not reach her family, passport taken away, and threats that she would be killed if she were ever found outside the house. So I leave you by saying we still have to continue to challenge ourselves of not only what does slavery and the slave trade look like today, what does a perpetrator look like today of slavery and the slave trade, but unless we're informed of how customs and practices and how integral slavery has been to our development of world history, including during the World War IIs, including today with the Yazidi community. ISIS at least was truthful enough to name one of its organizations the Slave Trade Administration.
Really?
Really. You know, and you went through judges when you traded your slaves to other fighters. That we have to be alert, this international use coercion, these international use coercion crimes are to be used and not to be thought of as part of fossilizedness. So I'll stop there and thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Human Rights Podcast. The podcast is produced by staff and students at the Irish Center for Human Rights at the University of Galway and supported by the University's Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. This episode was produced by Kirsten Larson.